We've passed the midway point in this book. You got 21 chapters, and we've looked at 11, so we are halfway through the book. But we get to chapter 12, and what's interesting when you get to chapter 12 is that while we're about halfway through the book, when you start in chapter 12, you're reading about the last week of Jesus' life. We've read 11 chapters that have encompassed bringing Jesus from eternity. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God, and bringing Him through His ministry those 30-plus years. But now in these last chapters, these last 10 chapters, we're only going to be reading about the last week of Jesus' life, and then His death, His burial, His resurrection, and the days that followed that. So John gives quite a bit of his space of writing to talk about that very significant time in the life of Jesus. Let's talk just briefly, and if you haven't got a handout yet, they're still coming around, but raise your hand if you don't have one, and they'll get one to you. Let's talk briefly just about just a few of the vital truths and concepts that I think we can draw from this chapter. The first one that's throughout the chapter, but I've just limited it to the first couple verses here, is that when we talk about the servants of Jesus, that's hopefully you and me, Jesus' servants show great respect, deep respect, and humility towards Him. Look in those first few verses. It was 6 days, verse 1 says, before Passover. Jesus came to Bethany. He came there a lot. Why did Jesus go to Bethany so often? He had friends there. We were just in Bethany in chapter 11. What did He do in chapter 11? Raised His friend, whose name was Lazarus, from the dead. Lazarus' two sisters are Mary and Martha. Jesus went through Bethany quite often because He had some very dear friends there. So He came back through Bethany. He is making His way to Jerusalem for the last days of His life. Comes to Bethany where He had raised Lazarus from the dead. Verse 2. There they made Him a supper. This is a supper in honor of Jesus. And what did Martha do? Well, what Martha was always doing. Martha was a servant. She was the practical one. Martha served. And on this occasion, Lazarus was reclined at the table with them. And Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard, that's New King James, anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped His feet with her hair. On Sunday, we're going to look in chapter 13, where Jesus took that towel and took that basin of water and He began washing His disciples' feet. Before Jesus did that in John chapter 13, Mary gets down in John chapter 12, anoints His feet, and if you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, she also anointed His head. But then she got down and anointed His feet, and she didn't use a towel. She wiped His feet with her hair. What does that tell you about Mary? Was she just too poor to afford a towel? Is that her problem? No. Mary tells you that she had long hair. Good point. Otherwise, it's just a scrubbing and not a wiping, right? She had long hair. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, as you read through various accounts of Jesus coming to them, were apparently, I don't know if we'd call them well off, but they were not poor by any means. The fact that Lazarus was buried in the family's tomb, that was very uncommon. But some have tried to estimate how much this oil was worth and have estimated that in our day it would have been worth about $500 or more. Why would she use something that would cost $500 to wash somebody's feet? Well, we're not just talking about somebody, are we? She was not skimping when it came to giving to the Lord. This was something that would normally have been done or used, Jesus says, at His burial. But He said, listen, instead of waiting till I was dead, What good, in reality, what good are you doing for a person after they have died to go and anoint them and to wash their body? For them, you're doing... So Jesus says, she didn't wait until I was buried. She's doing it for me while I'm still alive. You see a great sense of humility in these two sisters. You see it throughout their accounts with Jesus. But when you go down later on in the chapter and Jesus starts talking about his servants and uses that word, look at how he describes them down in verse 26. He says that his servants are those who follow him, who honor him at the end of honor the Father. The Father will honor them, and that they will be where he is, the middle of verse 26. We need to be servants of the Lord, not servants so that we can get some kind of credit or some kind of accolades for what we're doing, but to be the kind of servant who is giving, who is generous. Here was Mary. She wasn't going to hold anything back from giving to the Lord. She was going to give her very best. Another thing that we see just briefly in that same part of the chapter is that doing good unto others, that's no substitute for worshiping. Mary comes. How do we define, and by we I say, how do the lexicographers define the word worship? The Greek word for worship is proskuneo. How do we define worship? What is somebody doing when they worship? They're prostrating themselves, they're falling down in homage, and they are kissing the ground in the direction of the one whom they are worshiping. Was there anything worshipful about what Mary was doing? Was she prostrate? Yeah. Was she down at his feet? Why was she doing this for the Lord? Was what she was doing for the Lord, was it different than what Judas wanted her to do? What did Judas want her? Judas is so noble, isn't he? I mean, he's always thinking of others, right? He's always looking out for the poor. But one of his disciples, Judas, verse 4, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" He is such a humanitarian, isn't he? "This," he said, "not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and he had the money box, and he used to pilfer what was put in it." Nice guy, right? Is he concerned about Mary? No. Is he concerned about Jesus? No. Is he concerned about the poor? No. He likes money. Covetous man. So he says, look, we should just be taking care of the poor. What's Jesus' response in verse 7? You know, some people are like Judas. They're always looking to criticize what other people do. But then there's some people who are like Jesus and they're always looking for something good in what other people do. Jesus said, wouldn't you like Jesus to say this about you? "Leave her alone." Wouldn't you have liked to have been there? Here's good old Judas, hypocrite. Guy who's saying, let's take care of the poor, and Jesus can see right through his heart. Knows he doesn't care a lick about the poor. And he looks at Judas and he says, "You leave her alone." Wouldn't you like Jesus to say that to Satan about you? Hey, back off. Leave him alone. Let her alone. She has kept this for the day of my burial, but as we've said, she was using it on this occasion instead. When you read the other accounts, you go over like to, I think it's in Mark chapter 14 is where Mark's account is. It says that she has done what she could. What could she do? Jesus is about ready to go to Jerusalem and die. What do you do for somebody like that? Do you ever feel at a loss to support someone, to comfort someone? And here's Mary. She doesn't know what to do. She just wants to show Jesus how much she loves him. And so you read those other accounts, and it says that Jesus said, "She's done a good work for me. She has done what she could. Leave her alone." And in fact, I think it's in Mark chapter 14, and I think it's in Matthew's account too, where it says, wherever the gospel is preached, what this woman has done is going to be told. You know, you think about Hebrews chapter 11 talking about Abel, he being dead yet speaketh. Here's Mary, and Jesus says, wherever the gospel goes, what this woman's done, it's going to be preached about too. And here we are fulfilling what Jesus said. Verse 8, for the poor you have with you always, but me you do not always have. How many opportunities would they have to serve the poor? How many opportunities would they have to do good unto the poor? Would there ever be a limit to that? Would there ever be a time where it would stop? Would there ever be a time where there wouldn't be any more poor? Jesus says, the poor you have with you always, but here I am. And what Mary is doing is needful. Think about a couple other truths here. I want to get to the theme tonight. Go down to verse 42. We have seen this several times in this book. The theme that we identified for the entire book is the theme that John identified in John chapter 20. In John chapter 20, verse 30 and 31, John says, these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Son of God. The purpose for which John wrote this gospel account is so that the readers would believe that Jesus is the Son of God. And we noted in that first introductory lesson several weeks ago that the word believe is a key word throughout this book, found over 90 times. You figure it out. Here's 21 chapters, and here's a word found over 90 times, almost 5 times in every chapter. You're going to read about faith and about belief. It's a key concept in this book. John emphasizes faith in this book more than it's emphasized anywhere else in the New Testament. So if you're going to read about the idea that somebody could be saved by faith alone, all they need to do is believe in Jesus and they will be saved. If you're going to read that concept in the New Testament, wouldn't you think you'd find it in the book of John? Because he talks more about faith, more about belief than anybody else. He talks more about eternal life and salvation. It's all throughout the book. So if you're going to read about somebody being saved by faith alone, wouldn't you think it's here? There's two passages in particular that you need to know from the book of John where John emphatically teaches just the opposite. We saw one in John chapter 8. In John chapter 8 and verse 30, there were many people who believed in Jesus. In verse 31, Jesus said unto those who believed in him, he started speaking unto them. Down in verse 42, he said, if God were your Father, hey, you're talking to believers. He says, you're believers, if God were your Father, verse 42. And then verse 44, he says, you are of your father, the devil. They were believers, but they were not of God. They were of the devil. So does faith alone, is that enough to save you? John chapter 8 says no. Now look in John chapter 12, verse 42. Nevertheless, even among the rulers, that's very unusual to find any kind of faith among the rulers because they were the ones trying to put Jesus to death. But even some of them had to honestly say, you know, this guy, he's kind of making sense, and we can't deny that he raised Lazarus from the dead. Even among the rulers, many believed in him. What's the word you have after that? Many of the rulers believed in him. Many of the rulers believed in him, but what does that say to you? It wasn't going to be enough. But because of the Pharisees, they did not, and this verb here on confess is a verb of continuous action. They were continually, not just one time, but they were over and over just not confessing him. It was not going to, they believe, okay, sure, they believed in him. That was a one-time act. But they over and over decided, we're not going to confess him. Were they saved? Dirk? Okay. Right. Well, whatever the conditions were for these people to be saved, had the Great Commission been given yet, were they required, as Dirk mentions, to be baptized into Christ, baptized by the authority of Christ? That was yet to be commanded. There was the baptism of John in Mark chapter 1 and verse 4, where he was baptizing them for the remission of sins. That was the purpose of John's baptism. was going out preaching, repent for the king, change, repent, kingdom of heaven is at hand, baptizing them so that their sins could be forgiven. But was belief in Jesus sufficient for them to be saved? The point here, we're not trying to say, well, they had to be baptized. The point here is, was belief on this occasion sufficient? And you don't even have to make the point here in John 12. Go all the way back to the Old Testament. Was there a time in the Old Testament where man could be acceptable in the sight of God based upon faith alone? Never. Never one time. There were men of faith like Noah. There were men of faith like Abraham. But when was it that their faith justified them? By faith Noah built. When that faith was put into action. And on this occasion, the two things that are being discussed are faith and confession. What's confession? That faith being put into action. And God says they had the faith, but they were not willing to put it into action. Then they were continually not willing to confess him. Why? Because they were afraid of the Pharisees. And number two, they loved the praise of men more than the praise of God. Will that get you in trouble? If you're out searching for approval and acceptance and popularity, if you want the praise of men more than you want the praise of God, what's that going to do for your soul? Is that going to help you? Yes, ma'am. Well, that's the difference that we find in John chapter, well, in several chapters, but since we're in John chapter 12, Jesus is separating in John chapter 12 those who are truly coming to him in order to hear and to believe and to follow him, and those who have no desire to do that at all. We may not have time to get to this later on in the study. Come over to, look in John chapter 12, verse 37. This is an interesting section of this chapter. John chapter 12, verse 37. But although he had done so many signs before them, what does this say? Jesus had done so many signs before them. But although he had done that, they did not believe in him. All right, so now we have a different reaction from verse 42, those rulers there, and these people in verse 37, they did not believe in him, even though he had done all. So Jesus does these signs, he performs these miracles. Do his miracles convince every single solitary person that he is of God? Do they convince every person that he is deity and they need to listen to his words? Why don't they? I mean, if you saw Lazarus, a man dead 4 days, and his sister said, "Don't open that tomb, he's going to stink." Of course, that was his sister. She was probably saying that about him while he was still alive, right? But anyway, 4 days in the tomb, there's going to be a stench. Don't open the tomb. If you were there, go back to verse 16. Nope, drop 17. We're coming back to where I was in just a second ago. Look at verse 17. Therefore, the people who were with him when he called Lazarus out of his tomb and raised him from the dead, what did these people do? They bore witness. There were people who saw Lazarus come out of the tomb, and they're bearing witness about what had happened. Go back up to verse 9. Look in verse 9. Now a great many of the Jews, that's talking about these rulers, they knew that Jesus was there in Bethany, and they came. But why did they come to Jesus? Not for Jesus' sake only, but that they also might see Lazarus, whom he raised from the dead. If you had seen Lazarus come out of the tomb, he was dead. 4 days dead. 4 days stinking dead. And now he's alive? In verse 2, he's reclined at a table with Jesus. In verse 9, they're not only coming to see Jesus. Is this guy really alive? Verse 10 says, then these other Jews plotted not only to kill Jesus, but verse 10 says, now who do they want to kill? Lazarus. Man, you just got back to life and now people want you dead again. But they, what did they know? They knew Lazarus was dead. They knew he was alive, but they knew because he was alive again that people were believing in him. And so they said, we got to kill him. We got to get him dead again so that people will stop believing him. So you've got a division, not only among the Jews and the common population, you've got a division among the rulers, among the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the chief priests, among who this Jesus is. Okay, come back to verse 37. Is that where we were? Although Jesus had done all these signs, there were those who did not believe in him. Verse 38, that the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke. Here's Isaiah 53. Lord, who has believed our report? In other words, is there nobody? He's performed all of these miracles and these people don't believe him. Lord, who's believed the report? Is anybody going to believe? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Everybody is seeing the miracles of Jesus, the revelation of God. Everybody's seen this, and they don't believe. Lord, what's going on here? They did not believe in verse 37. But what does verse 39 say? It's an interesting word here. Verse 37 says they did not believe in him. Verse 39 says they could not believe. Wait a minute, I thought everybody could believe. Why could they not believe? Here's what some people say about this passage. They say that God made it so that they couldn't believe. And God put them in a situation where he just damned them to hell and he didn't care. And he just needed some people to take the fall. And so he condemned them. They couldn't believe even if they wanted to. That's not what this verse says. Jesus performed all of these miracles. Verse 37 says they didn't believe in him. Verse 39 says they could not believe in him. Because Isaiah said later on, earlier on, because the previous quote was from Isaiah 53. Now he's quoting from Isaiah 6, where Isaiah was told he has blinded their eyes and hardened their hearts, lest they should see with their eyes, lest they should understand with their hearts and turned, so that I should heal them. In this passage, as was often done in the Old Testament, God is said to have blinded them. God is said to have hardened them in a similar fashion that it was said that God hardened Pharaoh's heart in the book of Exodus. Why could they not believe in him? Was it God's fault? No. It was their fault. Jesus performed these miracles. And by the very act of doing these miraculous signs, the people were divided into two camps. The ones who were honest, the ones who honestly looked at that and said, I cannot but say, that's a sign from God. And those who were in the other camp, who were so fixed in their hatred that they could not allow themselves to get over there and believe. I can't do it. I don't care what he does. Jesus could have raised everybody out of the graves. They wouldn't have cared. Jesus could have taken Mars and brought it to Earth and hit it with a baseball bat and made a home run or something crazy. They wouldn't care. Jesus could have done anything in the world. They were so set against him, it would not have mattered. They couldn't believe because of the choice that they themselves had made. Getting off on a side note there, but go to verse 48 and the last three verses, and then I want us to look at some of the theme tonight. The last vital concept I want us to see, if you don't know John chapter 12, verse 48, you need to know this verse. But before we get to verse 48, back up to verse 47. Jesus says, and if anyone hears my words. If anybody hears my words. Back up to verse 44 now. Verse 44, Jesus says, he who believes in me. What would make somebody believe in Jesus? What makes somebody believe? I mean, is that a prize you get in your McDonald's Happy Meal? Oh, I got belief today. How about that? What would make somebody believe in Jesus? Seeing what he did. He who believes in me believes not in me, but him who sent me. Verse 45. He who sees me sees him who sent me. I have come as a light into the world that whoever believes in me should not abide in darkness. An emphasis on believing. And then he gets to verse 47. It says, if anyone hears my words and does not. Who's got a New American Standard? Does not do what? Keep them. Not sure why King James, New King James, puts the word believe there. He had used the word believe in verse 44. He'd used the word believe in verse 46. This is not the word, this is not the Greek word believe in verse 47. It's the word keep. If anyone hears my words and does not keep them, I do not judge him. I don't condemn him without opportunity, in other words. For I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. Some people get so fixed on verse 47 that they never look at verse 48. They see Jesus say in verse 47, I don't judge them. If they hear me and they don't do and they don't keep my words, I don't judge them. And so they misunderstand, misapply, and say, look, Jesus doesn't condemn. He doesn't judge people who don't do what he says. That's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying, I came into this world to save mankind. And everyone who's going to hear my words and keep my words, they're going to be saved. All right, but what about those who don't keep your words, Jesus? Look in verse 48. He who rejects me is rejecting him in verse 48. You think that's the same thing as not keeping his words in verse 47? It's the exact same thing. If you reject his words in verse 48, what are you doing in verse 47? Or if you reject his words in verse 47, what are you rejecting in verse 48? Him. It's you can't reject, you can't, well, I think I'll take Jesus, but I don't care about his words. He rejects me and receives not my words. What does Jesus do in verse 48? If you want me, what else do you have to take? Now, you got to take what I say. You got to take my teachings. Well, what if I don't want it? What if I don't like his teachings? What have we done with him? He rejects me and receives not my words, has that which judges him. The words that you don't like, the words that I have spoken, will judge him in the last day. What's going to be the standard of judgment when you and I are standing before Christ on the day of judgment? Is there going to be a different standard if you live in a different country? Different standard if you live in a different century? Different standard if you live in a different part of this country? Is there a different standard whether you're white or black? Is there a different standard whether you're Democrat or Republican? Is there a different standard? What's the standard? Revelation 20 and verse 12 says that they were judged according to the things that were written in the books. What's one of the books? Well, the book of life is mentioned in that verse. How do I get into the book of life? I've got to do what this book says. Jesus says there is an authority, there's a standard by which man is going to be judged. And if he rejects it, what does he have left? Is there anything else that's going to justify him? Jesus says, if he hears me but he doesn't keep my words, I don't judge him. In other words, is this on this screen, 318? In 318, Jesus said, he who doesn't believe in me, he's condemned already. I mean, if you don't believe in Jesus, if you're not willing to obey Jesus, you're already condemned. You're already judged. Because you've rejected the only path to salvation that there is. All right, let's get in. Oh, I forgot I had two slides on this. There's the rest of it. Doesn't receive my words. That's what I was talking about, and I forgot to get to this slide. Good. All right, you got all that? Here's the theme. We got 7.5 minutes for the theme. As we said, when you get to chapter 12, you are transitioning. Sort of like when we got to chapter 6, we were transitioning. Because the first period of Jesus' life is when you might say he was in the height of his popularity and there were a lot of people that were following him and amazed by him. And then you get to chapter 6 and there seems to be a turn where now there's a lot of hatred and animosity towards him by the rulers. And so they're continually looking to kill him. And then you get to chapter 12 and now you're looking at the last week of his life. And when you get to chapter 12, you've reached a transition point. Because everything up to this point in this book, chapter 2, chapter 7, chapter 8, Jesus had said, my hour is not yet come, my hour is not yet come, my time is not yet come. Jesus kept saying that in those first chapters. It's not here, it's not here, it's not here. Then you get to chapter 12 and verse 23, and what does Jesus say? Chapter 12, verse 23. My time has come. It hadn't come before that day. But now he says in chapter 12, verse 23, my time has come. And every other time you read about his time in the book, chapter 12, the latter part of it, chapter 13, 16 to 17, when you read it from that point on, his day had come, his hour had come. Remember, that's the last week of his life. So it's all in this same point. He says, my hour is not yet, not yet, not yet. Chapter 12, it's here. What's his hour? Was Jesus having a hard time telling time? I mean, what's the deal? What's his hour? It's the hour of his death. The time had come for Jesus to die. Up to this point in the book, there were several times where the religious leaders wanted to kill him. Remember when they came and they wanted to stone him, but they didn't? Remember when they came and wanted to arrest him, but they didn't? And several times in there, you'll read about the fact that the Bible says, because it was not yet his hour. God providentially put some kind of protection around Jesus so that his time of death did not come, and God's scheme did not come prematurely. God had a plan. At the end of the plan, yes, his son was going to die. But he had work for his son to do. Remember Jesus said, my will is to do the him, my meat, chapter 4, is to do the will of him who sent me. Chapter 9 and verse 4, he said, while it is day, I've got to work. The night is coming when no man work. Jesus knew he was going to die. But he said, until that day, I'm going to work. Because God had a work for him to do. But the time of his death, was coming. So we're looking at these last 6 days. The last week of Jesus' life, he knew he only had a few days left, and that terminology is used throughout this chapter. And when he looked at his death, it's interesting the word that he chose to use in verse 23, chapter 12, verse 23, he says, the hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. How can you look at dying as a time of being glorified? That's the way Jesus looked at it. He said, the hour, my hour has come in order that I might be glorified. What was so great about the death of Jesus that he would say it was time for him to be glorified? He's going to receive all authority. Is that what you said, Jerry? He's going to receive all authority. Look at verse 27. Now my soul is troubled. We read that a lot in these last days of Jesus' life. And what shall I say? Shall I say, Father, save me from this hour? Well, he said in verse 23, my hour has come. So he's going to say, okay, now that my hour is here, hey, God, beam me up. I'm ready to go. I'm done. Am I going to say that? Jesus says, not on your life. Father, save me from this hour? No. But for this purpose, I have come to this hour. Jesus knew why he came. He knew that he came to die, and he looked at that occasion and he said, it's a period when I am going to be glorified. He's going to finish the purpose for which God gave him, and he knew the time was nearing when he was going to get to go back to heaven to be with his Father again. Jesus looked at his death as something that was absolutely essential. It was not optional. It was something that absolutely had to be done. We are going to run out of time. Come back to verse 28. Let's just look at some of these verses. This is just good stuff. Verse 28. Father, glorify your name. I don't know if we know that this part's in the Bible. Then a voice came from heaven saying, I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. A voice. When you think about Jesus, the life of Jesus, and you think about a voice coming from heaven, when do you think about? His baptism. This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. What else do you think about?
Transfiguration.
This is my beloved Son in whom I'm well pleased. Hear ye him. Three times a voice came from heaven in the lifetime of Jesus. One time, and this is on your sheet, but I'm not there yet in here, so you can find it. One time is when he's baptized, beginning of his ministry. One time's in the middle of his ministry, about there when he's transfigured. And now a voice from heaven comes at the end of his ministry. So all of this was just to build Jesus up, right? All of this voice from heaven business, all of this was to build Jesus up and to encourage him and to assure him, right? That's not what Jesus says. Jesus says in verse 30, it wasn't for me, it was for you. Verse 31, now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler, the prince of this world, is going to be cast out. Jesus was going to die on the cross. What's going to happen to Satan? He's done. His days of domination are done. Jesus came out of Hades, book of Hebrews tells us, with the keys. Sin, death, the grave, no more power. Verse 32, Jesus says, and if I am lifted up from the earth, what's he going to do? Draw all men unto him. This he said, signifying by what death he would die. It's interesting that Jesus, it was not unknown to Jesus how he was going to die. Under what circumstances would he die? Would he die of natural causes? How was he going to die? It was not unknown to him. They could have killed him perhaps in any number of ways, but the most cruel and vicious and humiliating of deaths was reserved for our Savior. Jesus knew that, but that did not stop him from going to the cross. This is a great chapter. There's so much in it, and I wish we had more time to look at it. I know the bell is going to get us. There's the thundering from heaven. Y'all get online and you can grab the rest of the PowerPoint if you want to fill in the blanks. But read chapter 13. Read chapter 13 before Sunday. We're getting into some shorter chapters here until we get to chapter 18. But some shorter chapters, it won't take you as long. But read through chapter 13 a couple times before Sunday morning. Thank you all for your good attention tonight.